I heard the story about two men who had been attending the same small country church in East Texas since they were little bitty kids. And after years of friendly fellowship, the two men divided company because of a terrible dispute that they just couldn't seem to resolve by themselves. And then in an attempt to restore their relationship, both men agreed to take the matter before one of the church's respected elders, who immediately invited them to meet with him individually. And so the first man met with the elder and proceeded to tell his side of the story. And after he finished explaining the issue, the wise elder affirmed this first man by telling him, "You know, you're absolutely right." Well, then the second man on the following night presented his version of what happened to this wise old mediator. And after explaining his point of view, the elder also responded, "You know, you're absolutely right." Afterward, the elder's wife began to scold her husband by telling him, "Those men told you two different stories, and you told them both that they were absolutely right. That's impossible. They both can't be absolutely right." Then after listening to his wife's complaint, the wise old man turned to his wife and with great wisdom declared, "You know, you're absolutely right." Here in our study today, we're going to consider what it takes to restore our damaged relationships. And as we begin to explore Nehemiah chapter 5, we quickly discover that all was not well in Jerusalem simply because of the strained relationships that were occurring within the close quarters of the city's walls. Remember, in our text last week, Nehemiah directed all of the Jews living in the hill country surrounding Jerusalem to move within the city walls so that they could be protected from the armies of Sanballat and Tobiah. And so those who lived in those rural farm areas, they moved into the city according to Nehemiah's plan. And while chapter 4 ended on a high note with every Israelite working together against the threats of their enemies, working together to rebuild that protective wall, the camaraderie of their community quickly turned into an outcry from the outcasts as the recently relocated Jews found themselves victimized by Jerusalem's upper class. And here in Nehemiah chapter 5, we're beginning there at verse 1, Nehemiah tells us that there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren, for there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." There were also some who said, "We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine." There were also those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards." Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. Well, according to Nehemiah, all was not well within the walls of Jerusalem. And while they were definitely winning the war against their enemies from without, they were slowly self-destructing from within simply because of the strained relationships that were occurring throughout the city. Look again there at verse 1 where we discover that there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. The first reason was based on the fact that there were many who were going hungry because they couldn't afford food. Check out verse 2 again where Nehemiah tells us that there were those who said, "We, our sons and our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live." Chances are this complaint came from those who had been working on farms outside of the city walls. And since now they're living inside of the city wall, they're jobless, they're penniless, and they're going hungry. The second complaint, it came from those who had taken out a second mortgage on their rural farms and homes. And check out verse 3 again there where Nehemiah tells us about those who said, "We have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine." Now, it's possible that there was a literal famine happening in the land at this point in time, or the word famine could also refer to the fact that there was this threat of war which brought all these people within the city walls, and so they're no longer working their land to produce the food they needed to eat. And so maybe they were having just a personal famine, and they were foodless. Either way, these poor people were taking out second mortgages and maybe even selling their property or selling their homes just so that they could survive during these days of hardship and hunger. The third complaint came from those who had committed their own kids to slavery just to pay off their loans. Check out verse 5 again where Nehemiah tells us there that there were also those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards, and yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And indeed we're forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards." Now as we read these shocking verses, we should understand that it wasn't an uncommon thing in this day and age for people to commit their kids into the employment of another. When we read that word slavery, we should understand that we're really talking about just kind of like a hardcore employment situation where a debt would be paid off by sending your kids to another household to be employed. They weren't going to be abused or beaten or that sort of thing. This slavery, it's not the same sort of tragic form of slavery that occurred here in America during the 18th and 19th centuries. And so we should understand that these people, they were just in dire straits, and they were taking out loans, and in order to pay off their loans, they were sending their kids to these people's homes to work off the debt. Well, after hearing about the exploitation that was occurring throughout the city of Jerusalem, Nehemiah tells us there in verse 6 that he became very angry when he heard their outcry. And there's good reason for that anger. You see, Jerusalem wasn't being destroyed by an exterior enemy now, but instead Jerusalem was being destroyed by an interior division that was arising from this usury. And the reason why is due to the fact that relational conflicts, well, they can quickly deteriorate into the discord and the dissension that will divide even the best of friends. Thankfully, before this conflict caused the collapse of this community there in Jerusalem, Nehemiah stepped in to help the Israelites to realize relational restoration. And as we examine the approach that Nehemiah used, we'll also consider how we too in our lives can realize relational restoration. And without debate, I'm sure we all agree that we've all experienced relational conflicts at some point in time. And we can be certain that there are times when the conflict is our fault. There are times when we are the source of the conflict. Therefore, as we continue examining our text today, we need to see that there are three things that we should do in order to restore the relationships that we've damaged. And the first thing that I want to point out in our text today is that relational restoration is realized when we first change our hearts. The second thing we'll find in our text this morning is that relational restoration is realized when we change our hope. And finally today we'll see that relational restoration is realized when we change our habits. And so with this as our outline, it's my hope that every one of us here today will learn to apply these relational principles to our lives. And as a result, we'll get to enjoy lifelong relationships with the people that God has surrounded us with. And so let's begin by considering how relational restoration is realized when we first change our hearts. Now it's been said, I agree, that the heart is the chief feature of the functioning mind. In other words, think about it like this. When it comes to the human psyche, we have the mind, which is described as the seat of our rational intellect. And then there is the heart of our psyche. The heart of our psyche, this refers to the seat of our emotions and our feelings. And so you have these two parts of our mind here. There's that rational side, that logical side that just thinks through things in a very logical manner. And then there's just the feelings. There's the emotions. There's the, I was hurt, or I was offended, or, oh, my heart hurts. Well, listen, when it comes to the conflicts that occur in every human relationship, our intellectual rationality is usually trumped by our hurt feelings and our inflamed emotions, which is why many people will simply allow disappointments and even disagreements to result in dissension and division. That being the case, we must understand that the path of relational restoration begins with a change of hearts. And here in our text today, the wealthy inhabitants of Israel provide us with a good example of this kind of change of heart. And so check out Nehemiah 5 here. We're beginning at verse 7, where we find Nehemiah leading the nation into relational restoration. There in verse 7, it says, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them and said to them, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. Well, here in these verses, we discover the steps that Nehemiah took in order to help restore the relationships of those in that community there in Jerusalem. And there at the beginning of verse 7, Nehemiah tells us that he spent some time in thought. And he spent some time in what he calls serious thought. Or in other words, after listening to the emotional outcry of the people, Nehemiah took the time to search his own heart and to search his own mind before presenting these two parties a solution for their relational conflict. From this, we should consider the importance of unbiased mediation for resolving relational conflicts. Oh, it's easy to go find someone who is just as emotionally charged as you are and in agreement with you to just sit there and go, yeah, you're right, you're right. That's easy to find. But no, we need to, like these people, go find unbiased mediation with someone who can give serious thought to the matter. You see, when two parties find themselves in the middle of a dispute, they're oftentimes so emotionally charged up that neither side is going to accept the solution presented by the other party. Therefore, if you find yourself in the middle of a relational conflict that appears to have no solutions, then like the inhabitants of Jerusalem, it's time to take the issue to an unbiased party who's able to think through the issue in a rational and in a biblical manner. Not just someone who's just going to fall into the emotion of what you're going through, but someone who can give serious thought to the matter. In the case of the conflict found in our text today, Nehemiah, he spent some time in serious thought. And after considering the details of this delicate situation, he tells us that he rebuked the nobles and the rulers. Now, the word rebuke there, found in verse 7, it actually comes from a Hebrew word that refers to the act of pleading with, striving with, and contending with another. Simply put, Nehemiah was telling us that he lodged a complaint against the nobles and rulers, and he said to them there, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. Or in other words, think about it like this. He was accusing these men of exploiting the needs of the poor for their own personal profit by providing loans to the needy, while charging them an exorbitant interest rate. Well, after considering the details of this conflict, Nehemiah tells us there at the end of verse 7 that he called a great assembly against them in order to expose their exploitation. Now, in order to understand the importance of this rebuke, I want you to hold your place there in Nehemiah 5 and turn with me to Proverbs 27. And as you turn to Proverbs 27, we should take a moment to acknowledge that no one really likes being rebuked. Anybody here I love being rebuked. Rebuke away. Tell me how wrong I am. I don't think anybody here likes to be rebuked. And yet we must understand that rebuke, well, it's oftentimes the tool that God uses to lead us into a change of heart that results in relational restoration. As a matter of fact, that's probably what Solomon was implying here in Proverbs 27. And we're beginning there at verse 5 where he writes, open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. In other words, we shouldn't get mad at the people who will take the time to challenge us and correct us, because they are the people who truly care for us. Open rebuke is way better than someone who is just loving you in silence. Now, with the same heart here, let's turn to Proverbs 15. Because in Proverbs 15, Solomon also explained the importance of the one receiving the rebuke. Because we first must acknowledge that the one who will rebuke us is the one who truly loves us. But then we must have the right heart in receiving that rebuke. And as you locate Proverbs 15, let's begin reading there at verse 31, where Solomon declares this. He says, the ear that hears the rebukes of life will abide among the wise. He who disdains instruction despises his own soul. But he who heeds rebuke gets understanding. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom. And before honor is humility. With these proverbs in mind, we must understand that it's the wise heart that will receive a rebuke. But it's the foolish heart who chooses to run away from those who attempt to correct them. And isn't that what we tend to do the minute someone comes along and says, look, I see that you have part of the problem. You're creating part of this conflict. You're at fault here. And you need to see it. And the person who comes and says that, if you receive that and go, wow, let me examine that. Let me go pray about that. Let me consider how that might be the case. The person who will receive that rebuke, that person is wise. But the person who just runs away and says, I don't want to hear it and I'm just not going to receive this, that person is foolish. Now, if you're having a hard time receiving a rebuke from a Nehemiah that God has placed in your life, then it's time to change your heart. Don't change friends. That's what we typically do, right? Oh, he rebuked me. She rebuked me. It's time to change friends. No, that's not the right way to go about this. It's time to change your heart so that you can receive the rebuke, because this is the way of true relational restoration. Therefore, rather than rejecting a rebuke, we would do well to simply receive it. Just like the rulers and the nobles did here in our text today. Check out verse 8 here. I want to consider their noble example. Here in verse 8, Nehemiah revealed how he publicly rebuked the rulers and nobles by reminding them that they had redeemed their Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. And he asked them there, now indeed, will you even sell your brethren, or should they be sold to us? Now these Jews could have rejected this rebuke in a few ways. For example, they could have argued these are the same farmers who are coming into the city with their crops and charging us money for their crops and making a profit off of us. They make a profit off of us every single time they come in and sell their goods in the city. And so, turnaround is fair play, right? I mean, we're just making some profit off of them now. What's the problem? They could have used that argument. They might have argued that, well, they weren't forcing the poorer Jews to take their high interest loans. They simply just offered them. That's on them for actually not having the business savvy to understand that this was a ripoff. That's on them. That's their fault. They could have blamed Nehemiah for creating the problem. They could have said, look, this is your problem. You told them to move inside the city walls. We didn't invite them in here. You did. They could have pulled the old, well, you know, Nehemiah, we could have received this rebuke if you would have said it nicer. It's not what you said, it's how you said it. We might have received this rebuke from you, Nehemiah, if you wouldn't have rebuked us in public. But since you rebuked us in public, we can't receive it. They could have used any number of reasons why they weren't going to receive this rebuke, but they didn't. As a matter of fact, there at the end of verse 8, Nehemiah just tells us that they were silenced and found nothing to say. They had broken hearts. They recognized what they had done wrong. And you know, it's possible that these farmers were ripping them off by charging them too much for their grain and goods. But two wrongs don't make a right. And someone has to realize what they have done wrong first before relational restoration can be realized. And these guys, they allowed Nehemiah's rebuke to change their heart about the way they were treating the less than fortunate. And please hear me when I say that we too must learn this lesson if we're going to enjoy the restoration of damaged relationships. And so we see then that relational restoration is realized when we change our hearts. Because when it comes to the relational conflicts that we all experience, we must be able to receive a rebuke about what we've done wrong so that we can move forward into restoration. Not only that, but we should also consider how relational restoration is also realized when we change our hope. Now, in the context of this study, the word hope refers to a feeling of expectation and the desire for a certain and specific outcome. And as we consider the relational hopes that we all have, I believe that if we're completely honest with ourselves this morning, we must admit that we tend to base our relationships on self-centered feelings, expectations, and desires. In other words, we usually approach our relationships with one of two questions. For example, when we enter into a relationship, we're usually asking a question like this: I wonder what this person can do for me. Or how about this? How will this relationship with this person benefit me? Well, then after we've maintained a relationship for a season and you know, people start to, you know, get to know one another, one of the questions that we tend to start asking in the middle of a relationship is, what have you done for me lately? What has this person done for me lately? And if not much, then maybe it's time to find some new friends. Because it's all about me. In other words, like the nobles and the rulers of Jerusalem, we tend to enter into and maintain relationships with the hopes that this relational connection will result in a personal profit of some sort. However, according to Nehemiah, self-centered hope is not the right basis for establishing lasting relationships. Check out Nehemiah 5 there, beginning at verse 9. I'll show you what I mean. Because here in Nehemiah 5, verse 9, Nehemiah says, "Then I said, what you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies?" Well, here in this verse, we find Nehemiah continuing to rebuke the nobles and the rulers of Jerusalem. And he insisted here that their hope for profiting off the less fortunate in their community, it wasn't a good thing. Now, the Hebrew word good there, it actually refers to the moral and ethical goodness as well as the goodness that results from prosperity. And so when Nehemiah was telling them that their hope for personal profit in this matter was not a good thing, he was actually telling them that it was both immoral, it was unethical, and it was also a hope that would eventually rob all of them and their entire community from the prosperity that they were seeking. He was saying, the prosperity that you're going to get from this is not good. Check out verse 9 again, and I'll show you how the hope that they had in this relationship for personal profit, it was actually destroying their community. You see there at the end of verse 9, Nehemiah referred to the reproach of the nations and their enemies. Now imagine for a moment, what if these farmers who had moved into the city just decided to abandon the building project altogether? Remember, they weren't done finishing the rebuilding of this wall. And so what if these farmers just decided, you know what, we can't survive here, we can't eat here, we can't make our living here, forget it. We don't care about the restoration of this wall. We don't care about the rebuilding of this wall. We're just going to go back and return to our farms so that we can survive. Well, if that would have happened, then the wall would stand incomplete. And with the incomplete wall, the enemies of Israel would continue to mock them and invade them and persecute them and be right back to business as usual. Or imagine that the relationships within the city walls continued to sour as this community continued to divide into two. And as a result, no one returned to the work at the wall. And so they all just stayed within the community, but everybody hates each other. And the enemies are still coming in and invading and disrupting life there. The half-built wall would then stand as a testimony to the surrounding nations that the inhabitants of Jerusalem were still just a reproach in the eyes of their enemies. Now, from this, we can see that when relationships are built upon the hope of personal profit, then it's only a matter of time until relationships are ruined and the community in which the relationships were formed just becomes completely damaged. And in the context of the church life, the world looks on and says, "See, the church isn't a good place, it's a bad place. Look at the hypocrites. Look at how they sue each other. Look at how they mistreat each other." We become a reproach in the eyes of those who don't love God. Listen, if you've been leaving a wake of ruined relationships behind you, then the chances are you've been entering into relationships with the wrong hope. For example, some people, like the rulers and nobles there in Jerusalem, some people enter into relationships hoping that others will meet their financial desires. And as long as there's money to be made there, as long as there's a profit to be made, as long as there's financial gain to be had, the relationship lasts. But as soon as that money starts running out, the relationship's over. Others still yet are hoping that the relationships they form will meet their emotional desires. But then the minute the relationship becomes emotionally taxing, the minute it becomes difficult emotionally to maintain a relationship with this person, well, the self-centered friend tends to move on. This is emotionally taxing. I just got to go hang out with somebody else. Some people enter into relationships hoping for physical companionship and intimacy, and that relationship will last as long as the physical attraction is still there. But the minute that physical attraction is no longer there, it no longer satisfies the senses, well, it's time to get rid of the old and bring in the new. And there are those who base their relationships on social ladder climbing, and they love to spend time with you until they get higher up on the ladder, if you will. Maybe you have friends that are more important than you in the social setting, and so they come and they're friends with you because they have that in row, but they meet some of your friends who are more important than you are, and so they chum up to those more important people, and next thing you know, they climb the ladder until they're finally at the top of the social ladder. Social elites. Now, if any of this sounds like you, if this has hit the bone here today, then I hope you'll have the right heart in hearing this rebuke. And I hope that you'll discover today that you can realize relational restoration by simply changing your hopes. Check out verse 9 again, and let's consider how we can have the right relational hope. You see there in verse 9, Nehemiah asked these men, "Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies?" Simply put, Nehemiah was telling the rulers and nobles to walk in the fear of the Lord instead of the fear of bankruptcy. They were walking in the fear of bankruptcy. They needed to make some money. They needed some cash. And so they were engaging in exploitation. They were using usury as a means of establishing a thick bank account. Nehemiah is saying, don't fear bankruptcy, fear the Lord. Now, as I pointed out before, the word fear, it speaks of reverential respect. And in the context of this relational conflict, Nehemiah was encouraging these men to start basing their relationships with others on a reverential respect of the Lord. In other words, Nehemiah was telling these men to stop hoping for the personal profit of relational domination and instead start hoping for God's will to be realized in their relationships with the rural farmers and everyone else. And in light of Nehemiah's encouragement, I think that we should take some time to consider what this change of hope should look like in our own lives. And so hold your place here in Nehemiah chapter 5 and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And as you turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, I want to point out that those of us who see our relationships as a means for getting rich, we need to change our hope. We need to change our hope by walking in the fear of the Lord. And we do this by hoping that God will use others, or actually will use us, to bless others with what He's given us. So that we're no longer looking at others as a means of getting stuff, but we're looking at others as a way of giving stuff. And those of us who are hoping that others will fulfill our emotional and our physical desires, we must change our hope by walking in the fear of the Lord. And we do this by hoping that God will begin to use us to fulfill the spiritual needs of our friends. We're no longer seeking those people around us to meet our physical and emotional desires, but we're seeking to meet their spiritual needs. Simply put, our relational hopes should be based on the fear of the Lord, which is a fear that will change our self-centered hopes into the heavenly hopes of our gracious God. And here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, when we begin there at verse 3, Paul presents us with an example of what this heavenly hope looks like. He says there, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. Now, if we are afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effective for enduring the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or if we are comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And our hope for you is steadfast, because we know that as you are partakers of the sufferings, so also you will partake of the consolation. Here in these verses, we find a man, Paul, who was willing to suffer the loss of all things. Why? So that others could be comforted to know the calling of Christ. He was willing to lose it all so that others might be saved. And while his outreach to the Gentiles, it caused great conflict in his life, Paul endured every affliction and he endured every hardship because his number one hope was that others might enter into an everlasting relationship with Jesus Christ by faith in his finished work. He was ready to suffer every day in the hopes that his life would lead others to Christ. Now that's having the right hope in the relationships that we form. And with Paul's example in mind, we too should learn how to endure every relational difficulty. We should learn how to endure every suffering, every conflict, so that the grace of God might come through our lives to those around us. We do this when we stop seeking the personal profit of relational domination and when we start hoping that God will simply use us to lead others into a closer relationship with Jesus. And so we see then that relational restoration is realized when we first change our heart, because lasting relationships are experienced by those who are able to receive the rebuke. Not only that, but relational restoration is also realized when we change our hope, because lasting relationships are experienced by those who are no longer hoping for relational domination, but instead our relational hope is based on the fear of the Lord, which leads us to be a blessing to others. Finally, we must understand that relational restoration is realized when we change our habits. In other words, a change of heart and a change of hope must also translate into a change of habits if we're really going to restore the relationships that have resulted in division. And with this in mind, let's check out Nehemiah chapter 5. We're beginning there at verse 10, where we find Nehemiah challenging the rulers and the nobles to change their life, to change their habits. There in verse 10, he says, "I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. Also, a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them." So they said, "We will restore it, and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say." Then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. Then I shook out the fold of my garment and said, "So may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied." And all the assembly said, "Amen," and praise the Lord. Then the people did according to this promise. Here in these verses, we find Nehemiah challenging these men to not only change their heart, to not only change their hope, but also change their habits. You see, these men had a bad habit of engaging in usury, exploiting the poor. It's for this reason that Nehemiah told them there in verse 10 to change their habits by declaring, "Please stop this usury. Stop doing what you're used to doing. Stop what you were doing before and start doing the right things." Not only that, but they also had the bad habit of keeping all of the profits that they collected through usury. They weren't giving to those in need. They weren't helping those in need. But they were just taking and keeping without remorse. Therefore, Nehemiah told them there in verse 11 to change their habits by declaring, "Restore now to them everything that you have charged them." Well, then after they promised to change their selfish ways, Nehemiah introduced a high and a holy level of accountability there in verse 12 as he brought in the priests. And with the priests there, he required an oath from them that they would do according to the promise. He was making them promise that they would change these habits. You see, Nehemiah knew that true relational restoration wouldn't last and this community in Jerusalem couldn't come back together if these guys continued returning to the same old bad habits. And so as a way of healing this community, healing this division, he made them promise before the priests that they would change their habits. Understand. We must understand the importance of these changed habits. And Nehemiah understood how important it was. And so he shook out the fold of his garment and he said, "So may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise." God has a way of leading us into righteousness, doesn't it? Doesn't he? He wants to lead us into righteousness, and there's the easy road of obedience. And there's the hard road of punishment. Either way, he's going to get us there. Thankfully, we get to choose the road. And so this promise that they made, they should stay true to it. And the promises that we've made to change our habits, we also must stay true to those promises to God so that we can enjoy that easy road of obedience rather than the difficult road of punishment. And from this, too, we must understand that relational restoration is realized when we change our habits and remain in that changed state. And now, in order to understand this better, let's turn to Colossians chapter 3. And as you turn to Colossians chapter 3, I should point out that the Christian who really wants to restore a damaged relationship must not only identify the bad habits that resulted in the relational dissension and division, but we must also decide to change the habits. And the reason why is due to the fact that the apology followed by the return to the same old, it's insufficient. Well, when it comes to relational restoration, the apology followed by the same old is just insufficient. It doesn't cut it. And it's for this reason that Paul declared here in Colossians 3, beginning there at verse 8, he says, "But now you yourselves are to put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free, but Christ is in all and Christ is all and in all. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful." Christian, listen, if you want to realize relational restoration with those who were once your friends, then you got to put off anger. You got to put off wrath. And you got to put off malice. And then, not only do you have to stop the bad habits of anger, wrath, and malice, you must start the new habits. You must put on tender mercy, kindness, and humility. You see, if you want to experience relational restoration, you must put off those bad habits of blasphemy and filthy language out of your mouth. And then you must put on the right things. You must start up the good habits. You must put on meekness and long-suffering. If you want to realize relational restoration, then you must put off those bad habits of lying to one another and then put on the good habits of bearing with one another and forgiving one another. And then with a heart that's filled with the love of Christ, we must learn how to take every complaint that we have against one another and simply forgive them. And if you're having a hard time offering that forgiveness, then just remember how much Christ has forgiven you. And just as Christ has forgiven you, so you ought to forgive those around you. And then as we engage in these new holy habits, we'll begin to realize relational restoration. Now, this doesn't promise that every relationship will be restored, because there's going to be people in our lives that will not apply these principles to their lives. But you see, that's between them and God. That's not between us and them. We can't come along and say, "Well, they're not going to do this, so I'm not going to do this." No. This is what we must do, regardless of what they do or do not do. Without a doubt, we've all allowed disagreements to become dissension and then even division. And I'm sure that we've all lost friends for all sorts of reasons. But I'm here to tell you that relational restoration can be realized if we would simply lead by example and follow Nehemiah's directions. The rulers and the nobles, they could have come with all sorts of reasons for why they were doing what they were doing and justified their course of action, but they didn't. And it's possible that they had all kinds of arguments and complaints against these rural farmers. But they simply received the rebuke. They recognized that in order to realize relational restoration, then they must change their heart, and they did. And so should we. We must change our hearts, because lasting relationships are only experienced by those who are able to receive the rebuke of another. We must be able to see where we've been at fault in the relationships that we have. Not only that, but we can realize relational restoration if we would simply change our hope. Remember, lasting relationships are experienced by those who are no longer hoping for relational domination and personal profit. But instead, lasting relationships are based on a relational hope that is found in the goal of bringing others to a closer relationship with Jesus Christ. And finally, we realize relational restoration when we change our habits. Because a change of heart and a change of hope must also become a change of habit, so that relationally destructive behaviors that we've engaged in the past will be replaced with a Christ-centered love that's constantly seeking reconciliation. Therefore, I want to encourage you, it's with a change of heart and a change of hope and a change of habits that we can realize relational restoration. Let's pray.